The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I'm going to give a talk on the hindrance of ill will. And it's part of a series of talks on the five hindrances that I began a couple of weeks ago. And this is the second. The first hindrance is sensual desire. Second, ill will. The third is sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness and anxiety. And the fifth is doubt. So these are common visitors to people doing meditation. And it's important to address it and look at these well. So today is ill will, whether you like it or not. And we're going to. So imagine that you're walking down a street, a wide street, and there's a really strong wind. I don't know what a strong wind is, but maybe like 80 miles an hour wind. And that's pretty strong, right? But can you walk in 80 miles? No, not really. Oh, okay, so 50 miles an hour wind. And 50 is better. So you're walking down the way, and how you can, you know, what happens as you walk depends on a number of factors. One depends certainly how strong the wind is. If it's maybe it's a certain strength, if you're walking kind of casually, it might push you 2 or 3 feet downwind, and you catch yourself, and you're strong enough, easy enough, you can push yourself back into the middle of the road, and then your casual wind catches you, and you can kind of right yourself as you go along. But at some point, if the wind is too strong, the 80 miles an hour, it blows you off the road. Another factor that plays into this is that maybe you're not so casual, but you're quite intent. And so you're really intent and resolved and kind of centered in yourself as you walk. And then the 50 mile an hour wind perhaps doesn't really push you over because you're really there for each step. Whereas if you're not quite there, it pushes you more easily. Then imagine you make it to a sidewalk that's maybe 3 or 4 feet wide. And now the wind is only 40 miles an hour. And same thing, if you walk too casually, it can push you, but you a little bit, maybe not 2 or 3 feet, but it can push you maybe a foot. And you can easily right yourself and go along. But if it's a little bit stronger, it might blow you off. But it doesn't have to be as strong as on the road, just a little bit, because it only has a couple of feet to push you. And then imagine that after a while you think, well, this is kind of fun, but let's walk right on the curb. You know, it's 4-inch curb. And now you could never walk on the curb on an 80-mile-an-hour wind. You can't do 50-mile-an-hour wind. You wouldn't be able to stay on there with even a 30-mile-an-hour wind, perhaps. But maybe with 20-mile-an-hour wind, you can do it. You kind of pushes you a little bit, but your body kind of gets pushed a little bit, and you kind of stand up straight, and you push against the wind, lean against it, and you can kind of walk that 4 inches if the wind is 20 miles an hour. Now, 20 miles an hour on the big boulevard, no problem. But for walking that curb, you've got to have a lot slower wind to succeed. How intent you are on walking, how casual, comes into play here as well. If you're too casual as you're walking, maybe 15 miles an hour is enough to push you off. But if you're really intent and centered, maybe 25 is okay. So then this is fun. So then you decide that not just a curb, but you're going to walk along high wire. Maybe it's only 2 inches above the ground, but you're going to try walking along high wire. You went to circus camp as a kid, and you've learned a few things. So you're going to try this high wire. And now on the high wire, 2 inches above the ground, a 10-mile-an-hour wind is too much. And, you know, 5 miles is too much. But maybe 4 miles an hour, you can kind of just manage that there. Unless you're really intent, then maybe 6 is okay. But if you're too casual, complacent, then even 1 mile is too much. Mile an hour wind. Get the idea? So the hindrances are like that. You've set yourself a course where you're going to go, take a walk, if you're going to go a certain direction in your life, and it can be almost anything you do at all. You want to do something. And you set yourself a course. And then at some point there can be winds in the mind, forces in the mind that come along that can have an impact on your ability to follow through on what you want to do. So there might be, there might arise ill will. If you have a wide boulevard, wide path, and an easy destination to go to, then you could have a rage. and you can manage to, you find your way down the boulevard, no problem. But that raging rage is not going to, you're not going to manage that if you're on that sidewalk. If you're just irritated, you might not even make it on the curb. If you're slightly annoyed, you might not even make it on the high wire. But slightly annoyed on the boulevard, you know, that's no issue at all. So depending on what you want to do, depending how easy it is to do it, the impact on these forces of your mind varies. Varies by the intensity of it, it varies by how intent you are for the purpose that you have in mind, it varies about the conditions you're in. So with ill will, anger, hostility, aversion, ire, rage, irritation, annoyance, what are some other good words like that? No more? I have a list. Ill will, aversion, anger, fury, rage, wrath, resentment, indignation, irritation, vexation, discontent, loathing, abhorrence, grudge, annoyance, spite, ire, resistance, avoidance, denial, boredom, criticalness, fearfulness, complaining. To list just a few of the possibilities. So some of these can arise in our mind, and they can derail us. They can push us off our path where we want to go. As people do meditation practice, and their meditation practice gets more quiet, more centered, more focused, it becomes more and more like you're walking on a smaller and smaller walkway. And a milder wind can blow you off. So if you're very peaceful, mind is very still and quiet, content, and see, this is good, I'm centered, I'm here, I'm not anywhere else. And then someone walks in to IMC with high heel shoes, you can hear the clicking on the floor, and it reminds you of how in the high school prom, I didn't go to high school proms. I don't know what happens there, but I guess you don't wear high heel shoes to the. You do wear high heel shoes to the prom. You do that. Huh? You can't dance, right? Doesn't matter. You can do. I don't know. That's so much I don't know. So you remember how someone stepped on your foot with those heels. And, you know, normally it's not a big deal, but somehow you get kind of irritated, you know, 30 years ago memory, and you find yourself kind of mind drifting off in those irritated thoughts. And off you go. You've lost your path. You're being pushed off your path. If you're literally driving your car down the freeway and you think about the same incident, chances of you being blown off the road, being somehow crashing your car, are pretty small in that circumstance. But if you're on your cell phone and someone says something phenomenally offensive to you that is so deeply kind of consequential for you and your life and your family and everyone, and you've just got filled with fury, then you might have an accident. You might get pushed over. So what I'm trying to say here is that in meditation practice, things which in normal life, maybe you can manage quite easily. If for the purposes of meditation practice, become a bigger deal. Something that's milder in daily life becomes a bigger deal in meditation practice. So this is true with the hindrances. So in the case of ill will, as we sit and meditate, it's possible to be pushed off by being caught up or get preoccupied by thoughts of aversion, feelings of ill will that come along. So part of what ill will is a hindrance, it's either a movement you want to strike out at something, push something, strike out, or push something away, or push yourself away from something, kind of aversion from it. Usually with a sense of, little bit of sense of hostility, but not always. It could just be kind of strong aversion. And it can happen very subtly in the body, in the mind. It can happen very powerfully. And it's fascinating. It's really fascinating to take the opportunity in meditation where you sit down, close your eyes in a meditative posture. Sit down and close your eyes. And then let it rip. And really feel like you've never felt before what a good bout of anger, irritation, ill will, hostility might be like. Just really feel it. Give yourself permission, because it's safe, right? You're not going to hit anyone. You know, you're safe. You're committed to not moving. And then just let it course through you. And then become a naturalist of those things. It becomes like become fascinated energetically, temperature-wise. Notice where the constriction and tightness is, know where the impulses are. Sometimes with aversion, it translates to a certain kind of impulse to act or move in the body. Sometimes there can be impulse to do something with your arms and hands and fists. You can feel that energy going surging down there. Or there might be the energy to, in your legs, or sometimes in the middle of the chest, an upwelling kind of pushing, often a pushing kind of feeling might be there. There might be a lot of energy in the brain or the head spinning around, or contraction and tightness there. There's a variety of sensations, ways you can feel the experience of it. And then according to this long list that I read, each one of those has their own characteristic manifestation in the body. So you're encouraged in this practice here to spend some time becoming a connoisseur of ill will. Not because it's just a good thing to do, you know, for its own right, you know, have a good time and sit with your ill will. But rather, it's so that you can get to know it really well. And one of the ways, very important ways, that wisdom is acquired is through familiarity, getting to know something really well. And it's rather unfortunate that's the case, because it's hard to become familiar with something unless you experience it again and again and again. So in that sense, it's kind of unfortunate. It's a painful thing. But often, that's a lot of the wisdom can come from that deep familiarity that comes from repeated contact. So with sitting in meditation, you get a very interesting laboratory for this work of familiarity. Partly because the more subtle movements of aversion and ill will, irritation, that normally you wouldn't even notice in your daily life, are consequential and noticeable in meditation. And some people are quite surprised to realize through the practice of meditation how pervasive certain attitudes are that seem to almost underlie the very kind of base, underlie the very orientation or approach with which they go through life. And in daily life, we don't notice so much. One of the common things people can notice is, some people will notice, is how pervasive fear is, anxiety. It seems to be under everything. Some people will notice how pervasive desire is, just wanting. And some people will notice how pervasive ill will, resentment, anger, aversion is. Some people, it's their default. They're kind of predisposed, or they're prepared, or ever prepared. Some people enter into an environment and already assume, in a brand new place never been before, that there is something wrong here, that there's something off, that People are not going to like them. People are irritating. People are difficult. This and that. And then they look in their environment for that. They kind of select out of the environment. And part of the danger of any of these hindrances is when it has the upper hand, that it influences how we see the world around us. And with aversion, it's very dangerous because aversion can have such negative consequences. If we act on our aversion or hostility and ill will, we act on it, we can cause harm to ourselves, to others, to our relationships. And if we predisposed or if default is to see, is to kind of be on the attack or the aversion, find what's wrong, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we see someone we've never seen before and assume that they're going to be irritating, and they say, "How are you?" And they've already lost. It's like, you know, the tone of your voice. How could you say it that way? I remember when I was at Tassajara, the Zen monastery. In the Zen monastery, during the formal periods of meditation retreats, all the meals happen formally in the meditation hall. And we sit in platforms, a little bit higher than this, but with a strip of wood in front, like I have in front of my platform here. And we put out our bowls, and we chant. And except for the chanting, it's all done in silence. And servers will come in with pots of food and stand in front of us and ladle up the rice and things into our bowls and then leave. And it's all choreographed. It's all this kind of ritual. And so as they come in, the servers, they have to bow to you. And you have to bow to them. So it's very nice, right? Someone's going to serve you food. You bow in silence. You can't talk, so you just bow. And they're holding the pot, and they bow to you. And we did this, you know, for months, for years, you know. And there wasn't much else to do. And one of the things... that didn't come out right. So how deeply the servers bowed, or when I was a server, how deeply the people sitting on the platforms bowed to me communicated something. Oh, that person didn't bow deep enough. They were bowing, right? But they didn't bow deep enough. Just a little, you know, a little nod, you know. And then I would be a little bit irritated, you know, and who knows why. Maybe they had a bad back and they couldn't go any further. But, you know, oh, what's this person have against me? So, you know, if I walked in, you know, I already was in a kind of an angry state of mind, you know, I'm already kind of like, oh, you know, look at that. That person barely budged in that bow. How disrespectful. And then, of course, then I hardly... But you bow when you start serving. When you finish, you bow again and then go to the next person. So then I'll barely bow back then myself. I'll show them. And then they see this little thing. And then, you know, gee, you know, what's with Gil? And pretty soon we have a war. Self-fulfilling prophecy sometimes. I don't know if that was the best example, but... Once, just to show you the other side of it, once I was serving, it was the end of a 7-day retreat, intensive concentrated meditation, silent for the whole week, and I was serving on the last days. And the custom is actually you don't bow in front of, you don't serve one person at a time, you serve two people at once. And so you stand between them, you bow to them, they bow to you. And when you, the server might take your bowl and they ladle the food into the bowl. And then when you hold your hands up in like this, in gassho, and like you're bowing to them straight up. And then while they're serving, and then if they have if you have enough food, you drop your hand like this, hold it flat, point it up to the ceiling, so that and lift your hand slightly towards the ceiling, and that means you have enough, right? And so I was serving someone, you know, and his partner, who was being served at the same more or less the same time. They're supposed to keep their hands up waiting for their turn like this. And so the partner dropped his hand down. That's enough. For the guy next to him, right? Well, I'm glad you laughed. Because I started laughing. And it said, there's 7 days of this intense silence. It's like the pressure had suddenly gone, right? It popped the lid on me. And so I started laughing. I kind of staggered backwards. And then no one else in the room knew what, except those two and me, knew what had happened. But then the people next to them and the platform on the wall, they started laughing because we were laughing. And then the people down there was like, the laughing rippled down the hall. And I started laughing so much, I had to put the pot on the floor and I fell on the ground and was holding my stomach. So, anyway, so things can get out of hand. So the ill will. Back to ill will. So if you want to meditate successfully, you need to become familiar with this ill will. Because a very simple ill will, even if you're not an aversive kind of person, even small bouts of ill will can pull you off. Because it tends to be involved with preoccupation. We get preoccupied in something. And you can't do meditation if you're preoccupied. If your mind is occupied with something else rather than being intent here, then you can't really do the mindfulness stuff. And what's interesting about this preoccupation with ill will is that your mind is occupied with some object, some concern. And it can be very captivating, that concern, partly because the story around that concern is so captivating, and also because there's so much energy in us towards it. We're so motivated, so juiced around it. Again, if you're sitting in deep meditation, you don't have to be that juiced, but there's enough juice to kind of derail you. So one of the interesting things to do, so there's a variety of things to do around studying or practicing with ill will. First, there's one that is seldom mentioned, but I want to read it. It's from an ancient text, Buddhist text, from the first century BCE. And it's the oldest record we have of a Buddhist monk teaching someone from outside of India. In this case, it was a Greek king. And the Greek king asked all these questions. And this monk, Nagasena, then answered. And these were recorded. And the monk said to the king, By water, we should understand the mind. By mud, the hindrances. But the mind's like water. If it's muddy, it's not going to be clear. So if you can get rid of the mud, the water becomes clear, the mind becomes clear. And by magic stone is a stone that you drop in the water and it settles the mud. And the magic stone, you should understand to be confidence. As soon as confidence arises, it makes the hindrances disappear. The mind without hindrances is clear, pure, and unsullied. So the role of confidence. Do you have confidence in the practice? Do you have confidence in yourself? Do you have confidence that the course you're setting yourself on is more important, more worthwhile than the course you're going with your preoccupation? If I sit here and start thinking about those high-heeled shoes at the prom, what's more important? To spin out, obsessing about my aversion, about high-heeled shoes and that person who stepped on me? Or to sit here and be intent and present and clear here and now? If I have confidence that that's important, the latter is important, then I'm less likely to go off in the high-heeled shoes direction. But if I have no confidence, then I might not even know what's important. And some people, confidence in the practice. Now, it's worse than that because some people, their confidence goes into their aversion. That's the way they have confidence. Somehow they have... you know, at least if you look at them or see how they act, that's where they put their faith. That's what they believe in. That's what they almost kind of get their identity from. That's where they get their juice, their energy from. Some people get energized by being aversive. Some people's sense of identity gets reinforced or strengthened by having aversion, some forms of aversion, because those people out there, they're the ones who are bad. And therefore, I'm one of the good ones. And so people play the whole aversion game sometimes. Sometimes as a way of kind of building themselves up. Not a few people I know on retreat have discovered that their critical judgmental mind, where they're judging other people, and on retreat, in daily life you might not see how painful that is, but if you go on retreat, a silent retreat, and you have to live with yourself for hours in silence, and you see this judgmental mind operating, start seeing the cost of it, how painful it is. And that's good, because then you're willing to look deeper and see, you know, the roots of it and try to kind of clarify it. And as people come back to me and clarified it, and some people have said to me, wow, that critical judgmentalness ahead of other people was really a way that I was trying to protect myself. And underneath my protectiveness was I was afraid. I felt very vulnerable. So it's not just simply a matter of creating an identity, but sometimes aversion is also a form of self-protection. I know some people who, when they feel pain or discomfort, what they do is they lash out. Ill will, aversion, that's what they have. That's what goes on. And it's not necessarily only to the world outside. It can be within oneself, too. There can be tremendous aversion, ill will towards oneself. You know, we feel some discomfort, some pain, emotional pain, and then we get angry with ourselves for having that. So to have confidence in the path, confidence in the practice, and give up our confidence in ill will is a very important step. It's important to spend time reflecting or contemplating or considering the topic of ill will. I recommend everyone spend time reflecting on it. Those of you who, for whom ill will is a regular dance partner, regular, you know, visitor for you, you might want to spend more time reflecting on it, thinking about it, talking to friends about it, because the process of contemplation and reflection can give you a deeper understanding and wisdom about what's going on in the whole experience of aversion, ill will. And as you understand it better and think better about it, have a wider understanding of it, then when you sit down to meditate, that understanding informs your meditation. Almost naturally. You don't have to think about it anymore, but just right there to support you. So what are some of the things you can contemplate? You can contemplate the cost, the personal cost of ill will, aversion, and anger. Think about that. Talk to people about it. Explore what the cost might be. The cost to yourself, personally. I've known people who started noticing how uncomfortable, how painful it was to be angry. And they said, you know, whatever the benefits are of being angry, they don't justify the cost. I feel so much pain wishing that person pain. What's the cost for our relationships with other people? What's the cost towards others? I've said things out of aversion that I've regretted ever since. I wish, you know, the cost, because not only for the cost for me, but the cost for that person. So how could I have said that, cause that kind of harm for someone else? A moment of mindlessness and something comes out my mouth. So to have a sense of the cost, the realistic sense, and not just kind of brush off or ignore our history around ill will, anger, aversion, but learn from it. So we can be wiser in the future. What might be the root of your ill will? What is the underlying condition that prompts it, that's a catalyst for it? The Buddhist word, the Pali word, the Indian word for hindrance, actually literally means to cover over. So what's it covering over? What's the underneath? What's prompting it? With ill will, aversion, sometimes it's frustrated desire. We really want something, and we're not getting it. And that frustrated desire, in some people's case, takes the form of anger or ill will. For some people, what's underneath it might be some kind of personal pain that we're unwilling to stay present for. The recoiling from our own pain, for some people, can take the form of lashing out, of criticalness. So perhaps what's needed then is to have a much improved capacity to be equanimously present for our pain, our inner pain. And actually, one of the great gifts of this practice is the ability to be comfortable with discomfort. What do you think of that? Why would you want to do that? Well, so you can be comfortable. If you're only comfortable when you're comfortable, then your life is pretty limited. But if you can be comfortable when you're uncomfortable, then all kinds of things are possible. So learn to be present. And one of the things is, when you learn to be present for discomfort, is we can understand it and see it and resolve it and deal with it in a much more realistic way. And then related to these things is, how does ill will, anger, aversion, skew your perceptions? How does it allow you to see really what's happening? There's a very strong tendency for ill will to be involved with preoccupation in some thing, some story, some person. And for us then to be blinded and not notice what's happening inside of us, our own suffering. So our perception is directed towards something rather than really taking into account the full picture. It's also selective. We select out of the situation that which we're critical of. We tend not to notice what's nice and helpful in the situation. You might spend some time reflecting, contemplating, how might it be a good idea? I say it this way for a number of reasons. One, so you do the work, and two, so you can't get out of it by saying, I don't like that idea. So I say it this way. In what way would it be helpful for you to consider your enemy as your teacher? The people for whom you have hostility or ill will towards, what inner kind of consideration, reflection, understanding do you need to bring forth so that that person can be a teacher for you? Now, you might never tell them that, but so you can learn something, so you can be transformed and changed for the better in that contact and that reflection. So these are all contemplations you might do. And you're walking around, drinking tea, talking to friends, and become wiser about this area. Another thing you might do, and it has to do with more spiritual practice, is to cultivate good qualities within us, cultivate ourselves. And the primary thing you're encouraged to cultivate in Buddhism as an antidote to ill will is goodwill, is friendliness, is loving kindness. And this is a very important virtue. It's a very important practice. It's a very important quality of heart that you're encouraged to learn, develop, and express when you do Buddhist practice. So that is a wonderful kind of balance or antidote. It's like being in a really strong wind, and I guess it's not the right best analogy, but a really strong wind and having really heavy shoes. So you can't be blown around. Another thing to cultivate when there's ill will is to cultivate and strengthen our capacity to be relaxed and calm, to learn how to relax. One of the ways to relax before you act. one of the great guidelines around ill will, anger, is don't ever make a decision when you're angry, if you can avoid it. Try to avoid making decisions, because you'll probably regret it later. So rather spend some time relaxing, and then when you're relaxed, perhaps you can kind of see clearer what needs to be done. Cultivate friendship with people who are not angry. Spending a lot of time around other angry people, hostile people, can reinforce our own hostility, our own ill will. Spending time with people who have goodwill can reinforce that. So cultivate friendship with people who have goodwill and let that kind of, you know, inform you, support you. The next thing is the mindfulness practice itself. And here is to learn to be present, to bring mindfulness to it. And there's a whole area, maybe for some of you I don't have to say much about it. One of the great possibilities of mindfulness is to learn how to be present for something, and while you're present for it, not caught by it. And it's a training we do in this practice to learn how to be present, how to be mindful, attentive to something, and while we're attentive, not be pulled around by the nose by the thing that we're paying attention to. So we can be present for anger, and anger doesn't have the upper hand. I remember once the magical moment on a retreat many years ago where I was doing walking meditation back and forth, and I had a walkway that was about 30 feet long, 25 feet long, and I was walking back and forth. And in retreats, you're not assigned a walking path, but you know, if you have your walking path, you know, that's your path for that time. And it was in a hallway at the Angela Center, and this person got into my lane. And I thought, oh, surely the person's just walking down the hallway to get someplace else. But when I turned around to go back, the person wasn't budging. It was a game of chicken, you know. In meditation, you know, what's this person doing in my walking path? So I got angry. But the wonderful thing was that the mindfulness was so strong that I had what at that time I called Teflon mind, where the anger just came up. I could watch it come up. It didn't stick anywhere. Just when it came up, but you know, kind of surged up and vanished. You know, within a second or 2 seconds, it was gone. Just whew. So to have that ability of mindfulness, a presence that can watch and see present for something, and the mind doesn't latch on, hook, and get caught. Mindfulness also allows us to see more deeply what's happening, the layers and layers of what might be the catalyst and the conditions that allows the hindrance, the ill will, to be there. So you have to be present to see that. Mindfulness also has a strong healing quality, because when you're mindful in a non-reactive way, which means you don't interfere with what's there, you allow the ill will to be there. Sometimes just allowing it to be there in the field of awareness, in the field of presence, it allows some inner healing or movement or relaxing to happen. And it's quite profound to see what inner healing capacity our psyche, our heart, our body has if it's given a chance. And mindfulness is a very powerful way to let the innate inner wisdom of healing kind of work through us at times. So that's the mindfulness is kind of the core what we do here. And then it's time to stop. But I want to mention one more practice to do with ill will, anger, hostility, rage, when nothing else works. You can do it before this. You don't have to wait until then. But nothing else works. And if you're, you know, if you've been on this path, if you're really committed to this Buddhist thing, then one thing you could do is you could go for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. maybe even put your hands together in front of your heart and kind of in this kind of gusho, this kind of, and maybe even chant it out loud if you're alone or silent in your mind. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, and I take refuge in the Sangha. And that can remind you of the values of what you have confidence in, the values you want to live by. It can help kind of evoke the support of the Buddha, Dharma, and your community, so you don't feel like you're doing it alone. That there's something bigger that's holding you. So it's not just up to you to struggle with this, but you're actually supported by something much more, you know, larger and bigger as well. So the hindrance of ill will. So now, for this next week, do not look for opportunities to have ill will. Don't go out of your way, please, to have ill will or anger or any of these good things. However, if it should happen during this week that you feel some anger, irritation, ill will, annoyance, you know, the whole gamut of these things, if it should happen, make it the week where you're going to study it. You're going to learn from it. You're going to explore it. You're going to reflect on it. So look for opportunities to study your ill will. This is the week for it. Isn't that good? Finally, you're waiting all your life. Now you can do it. And I'd encourage you in this exploration of this that you find someone, friends or strangers. Some of you will prefer strangers, where perhaps you have a chance to, you know, you sit down next to someone on the bus and say, "Hey, I was given this homework. I wonder if, you know, what wisdom do you have about ill will?" And then you might get some, unless the person gets irritated. So. Enjoy your ill will this week. Thank you.